You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hi everyone, I'm Hillary Kerr, the co-founder and chief content officer of Who What Wear, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I have a true LA legend on the podcast, Jessica Coslow, the chef and owner of the celebrated breakfast and lunch cafe, Squirrel. If you're a foodie, LA-based or not, you're probably familiar with her renowned cafe that started selling jams and preserves and has grown to become a quintessential staple of the LA food scene. Jessica is also a best-selling cookbook author and a two-time James Beard Award nominee. And of course, she's not stopping there. Her latest project just opened. It's the highly anticipated restaurant Onda, for which she teamed up with Gabriela Camara of Contramar in Mexico City and Kala in San Francisco. Jessica is undoubtedly one of the most beloved chefs in the entire country, which is why you'd probably expect her to come from a prestigious culinary school pedigree. But instead, she actually worked in digital production for clients like American Idol before her love of food eventually won her over. It's a great Second Life story, and I can't wait to share it with you. Now, on Second Life, it's Jessica Coslow. Okay, Jessica, so on this podcast, we like to start at the beginning. So what did you study in school and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
What did I think I was going to be? So I went to school for film studies and economics at Brandeis University. And then I went to graduate school, which we'll get to, at Georgetown for a master's in communication called CCT, Communication Culture Technology.
I read about that.
So it all kind of was in this idea of entrepreneurship in, I would say, the entertainment industry.
And through visual mediums.
Through visual mediums. So I didn't really realize it at the time, but that was what the trajectory looked like for me.
And I also read that you were a competitive skater. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about that and how you got into it.
Yeah, I went to a birthday party when I was 5 years old. And the thing about figure skating in Southern California is that it's competitive because it's not something that's a pastime. If you live on the East Coast and it's winter, it's like the idea of a pastime. But here, you know, your pastime is the beach.
Right.
So if you are a figure skater, you are doing it competitively because you want to win. But my mom could not get me off the ice. And from 5 till about 19, I was skating from, you know, 4:30 a.m. to then I went to school, and then I would get out at 12 and I would skate again. So, you know, from a very young age, I learned what it meant to be passionate and focused about a thing.
And you really loved it.
I loved it. Yeah, I was on the U.S. team for 4 years. I was national champion in a sport that does not exist anymore.
Tell me about that. What was that?
It's called school figures, and it was last in the Olympics in the 80s, the late 80s, and then it slowly moved out of existence. There were these intricate figure eight patterns in the ice. It was a very quiet sport, and it's all about tracings.
Also visual.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about it that's really interesting and I think why it no longer exists is because it was a sport that was quiet. Mm. And it was a sport where you had eight judges on the ice watching you skate and an audience that would have to not clap. Your outfits were not shiny. And the actual competition would take all day because each competitor had to do three different patterns, which also brings me to why I started as a jam maker which is a very slow and thoughtful and precise thing that happens in a jar that is quiet. Yeah.
That's interesting. So do you think that level of competition was good training for you to become an entrepreneur?
Absolutely.
Because that level of dedication just seems so intense at such a young age.
It was. And I think it also makes you hard to understand other people sometimes. Mm. When you find other people in your sphere who grew up being competitive or focused on a thing, it's such a relief because I know that it's kind of what drove me to then move on into the food space, which, by the way, as a figure skater, it meant that I didn't get to taste a lot of things growing up. And so when I stopped skating, this aha moment of like, well, now I can experience all these foods and culinary delights that I never was really tempted to go experience while I was skating because I was so...
It was restrictive?
I mean, in a way, yeah. I'm 5'4", which is actually tall for a figure skater. And so I was bigger than the other girls. And so it was always a comment or a concern. So anyway, the focus of having the figure skating in my background led me to that extreme passion on the food side. And I also have to thank my mom. You know, my mother was a single mother. She's a dermatologist with two practices. She's in her 70s and still practices 6 days a week.
So drive runs in the family.
Yeah. I mean, or it runs with her for sure. And that's a role model, mm-hmm. you know, that I had growing up to look up to find. At some point when I was young, I was like, oh, man, like being an adult and just working all the time. I hope I'm never like that. And now that's exactly what I am. You know, if you can find passion in your work and work in your passion, you hit it. You hit the strike. And I do believe that we still need to find the balance in life, mm-hmm. whether it's like your love of family or your love of activity, your love of nature, your love of, you know, your friends. And that really is a balance that sometimes can be hard for me and also I think about all the time. So I don't disregard that in terms of building the things that I'm building. Your relationships with people and your family and yourself are still really an important part of like how you can build a business and be passionate is by being passionate to who you are too.
So, also, I feel like there's that thing where how can you create something or make something if the well is dry? Hmm. So you have to keep filling that up with experiences, with inspiration, with love, with, you know, pleasure, with all of those things that happen in a well-rounded life. And I have tricked myself into concentrating more on some of those well-rounded pieces by telling myself it's also good for work.
That's true.
So how did you end up at Georgetown? And let's talk about that time of your life.
Well, I think the interesting thing is that, you know, figure skating was such a big part of my life that going to college and was more like checking off the Common app. Mm-hmm. I knew I wanted to experience something on the East Coast, and I was still skating when I moved to Boston to go to Brandeis. And so the college was – the choice of where to go to school was almost secondary because I was still in this skating, you know, thing. Once I was getting close to graduating, I realized that I never got that college experience that I had signed up for in a way. Like I hadn't made the active choice to like, what kind of college did I want to go to? And I felt like I had missed something. And CCT, this communication program within media, kind of was that next step from being a economics and film major. And so I applied to a number of schools and that was the one that resonated the mm-hmm. most, and that's where I went. And I kind of had this college experience that I never received.
So I read an interview in which you said that the program was sort of part MBA and part academic. What were you studying exactly? And what did you think you were going to do with that degree?
Well, it's funny. I think that there's four different kind of outcomes from that school. You end up either you go into media theory and you become a professor, which some of my friends from that program have become. Mm-hmm. You work at a place like Google or Instagram, Facebook, and you help to develop the future of mediums, or you do what I ended up doing, which was become a producer in digital in the digital space. So you become a producer or director or something in, you know, the most current form of digital space. Mm-hmm. Or you do what I eventually did, which is do none of those things. So,
what did you think you were going to do next, and what did you do next?
Well, the thing is that when I was at Brandeis and mm-hmm. I stopped skating, so as I said, I was on the U.S. team for 4 years, and then when I went to college, I competed in this collegiate games, which was the last, like, competitive competition in school figures in the world in 99, and I won, and that was it. So—
You won the last one?
Yes.
That's amazing. Yeah. What a way to go out.
Yeah, in the Olympic level, last competition, flowers on the ice. It was very sweet.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And after that, as I was stopping skating, there was always this curiosity about food because I was curious and never really got to experience those things. And at the time, I had met someone named Jensen who lived in Boston. His family was a third-generation cranberry farmer family. They're part of the Ocean Spray Co-op.
Wow.
And he became, like, my culinary date. You know, like, we would go out and have dinners and, like, experience a new place in Massachusetts. And then I got really into cooking. He took me to his farm. Like, I got to taste a cranberry, like, off the bog for the first time. It was just one of these things where I was like, this is something that I never experienced, and my eyes were wide open in the same way that I was five skating for the first time. Mm-hmm. And so I was cooking a lot at home, and that was the start of me wanting to know more, but also coming from a place of, all right, I have a mom who has worked her whole life and expects me to be a professional mm-hmm. and has given a lot for me to be at school and to be in the places that I've been, and like kind of pushing off that passion for being in the culinary world because I was scared to let her down, scared of like what that meant. And so I just kind of did it for myself and continued this path of being in a professional space.
So it was sort of a hobby.
Yeah,
it
was a hobby. And then when I moved to DC, it was still a hobby, but it was getting more of a like, why am I in this program doing this work when I know all I want to be doing is cooking. That's all I do with my time.
Were you working in restaurants at this point?
No.
So it's just like you're cooking for yourself, cooking at home.
Cooking for myself, cooking for anyone who would eat it. I was just like a great dinner party host.
Got it.
You know? And it was something that I knew I was craving to do, but I was still in the school program. And again, it was, I was scared. I didn't know how to get there. You know, like I knew that starting at five meant that I could be a figure skater. I didn't know that starting at 25 or 23 could lead me to be a professional chef.
Right.
So I think that was a concern or, you know, a doubt in my mind of doubting who I was and what I could be.
So you kept focus on the professional work mm-hmm. and in the communication space.
Yeah, in the communication space. But I also, at the time, I started dating someone who was very supportive of the culinary stuff that I was doing. And I moved to Atlanta after I graduated from Georgetown to be with him because he had a job down there. And the first night, we went to this place called Bacchanalia, which is owned by a female chef. And I sat at the bar, and the whole kitchen was glass, and you could just watch all the chefs dance. You know, mm-hmm. they were just working inside. And I was mesmerized. And I should back up a little bit. When I was cooking, I did savory and sweet, but, like, I have a sweet tooth. And so at home, the majority of the stuff that I was doing was in the pastry space. And mm-hmm. so I knew I wanted to work in pastry if I could ever get a chance. So I was just watching this dance, and I was like, this is a place that I need to work. Anne is, I would say, the Alice Waters of the South. I always refer to her as that, but she's so much more. She has a farm herself.
Wow.
And she has been a champion of Southern food systems and using and fermentation and preservation and fine dining and just like what it means to be in hospitality since the 90s, I think. And by the time I was there, it was 2005. Mm-hmm. So I just left and I was like, I have to work here in that crazy, you know, yeah. that passion way. And I sent her an email, which no one did at the time. And I was like, I will wash your floors. I will scrub whatever you need to scrub. Like, please let me work for you. And at the time, I also had a friend at CIA, at Culinary Institute of America, and she had been applying to all these restaurants to get a stage. Mm-hmm. And she was like, that is a crazy place. You're never going to get in there. The thing for me was I had the luck of proximity, yes, which meant I lived right there. And I also had the luck of being available. And I guess a pastry cook had just left, and she needed to fill that gap. And she brought me in the next day. She laughed at me. She's like, this is the funniest email I've ever received, because I was begging.
Yeah.
And she was like, but I need help, and you're hired. I had no idea what I was doing. Zero. I was like,
what were you hired to do?
To be a pastry cook.
Holy cow. With no training.
No training.
Wow.
Zero training.
No experience.
And I was honest about it. I was like, I'm an avid baker at home. And let me say that this happens a lot now. And for anyone who's listening, who's thinking about transitioning into the culinary world, because we get a lot of emails about, do you take stages? Can we work for you? And it's a different time. So I would say it's hard for small places like Squirrel to take on stages, because we're so small and that everyone has to be jumping on a train 100 miles an hour. If it's a bigger place, like a place like Bacchanalia, which had so many moving parts, it has Star Provisions, it has the fine dining restaurant, it had a place called Quiñones, which is its like really fine dining restaurant, and then Float Away. If you're wanting to go in the culinary space, like, that's what you do. You find a space that maybe has, like, it's meatier.
Multiple parts.
Totally. So it can take the risk.
And there's more infrastructure, mm-hmm, in that way.
And structure for, like, what the product is. You need a place that has consistency and structure. And I just lucked out with that.
So what was your first day like?
Scared. I was so scared. I was like, I'm a hack. You know, like, what? How did I end up here?
Did someone show you the ropes? Did
totally.
You have, like, specific things that you needed to learn how to make immediately? Did you feel like it was something that you could get your hands around at some point?
I mean, the thing about being a home cook versus being a restaurant cook, well, two things. One is, like, the, you know, the batches are so much bigger, because you're making a batch in a 30-quart Hobart versus, like, a small kitchen, 5-quart KitchenAid. Mm-hmm. And then there's all these techniques and tricks and, like, real structured. I think there's a tenderness that you can use when you're working at home, like an eyesight. But things can be really structured in a restaurant, where you, mm-hmm, need a thermometer on you, you need your Sharpie on you. Like, even, like, what is your toolbox that you bring to work on your first day? You've got an offset, you know, your Sharpie, your ThermoPen, you know, your knife kit.
So normally you would come with, like, your whole kit,
yeah,
of
you
things.
Bring, like, a toolbox, like a knife fold. And
the,
like,
same way chefs show up with,
yeah,
their own knives.
Yeah. Yeah. There are certain things that you show up as a pa- and, like.
You had none of them?
No. No. So embarrassing.
So how long were you there, and how did your responsibilities change over time? And what were you learning?
I was there for a year, and my responsibilities changed as I was able to be present, you know, as I was able to learn new tasks. And just from learning how to make ice cream without having the eggs curdle, or caramelizing hundreds of apples over the winter time, because who else was going to do it? You know, you learn how to do it quickly and efficiently so the caramel doesn't, you know, get cold. Just the techniques that you would learn in culinary school, in some ways, you're learning on the job, head down to work. And I'm so grateful for being humble enough to just completely fail and embarrass myself many times in front of those around me, and for the opportunity to succeed in front of really, really talented people, you know.
That's incredible. Also, it kind of strikes me of college and grad school all at the same time. I mean, just to have that intense hands-on work experience, that is incredible.
Mm. Yeah, I think those are the moments that you feel the most alive, when you're, like, just thrown into the deep end, and you just acknowledge that maybe, like, you don't know how to swim yet, and that you're going to try your hardest, and, you know, just go float on your back for a second. That was a really empowering time. And you know what? I still have those moments today, where it's just a matter of being thrown into the deep end and learning a new part of who you are and what you're capable of.
And you definitely don't know until you have that crucible moment.
It's true.
It's trial by fire. You got to see what comes out the other
exactly.
side.
Exactly.
So you did that for a year, mm-hmm. and then what happened?
I was feeling very worried about what I was going to do, you know?
Like long-term, you
long-term, you know? You go in, you're making $10 an hour. You went to college and graduate school. You've got someone on each shoulder telling you what you're supposed to do. And I knew I also was going to move to New York. And I just knew that if I didn't try the other thing that I had gone to school for, I don't think I'd be standing here today for sure. So I moved to New York and I started working at Fox. I got a job as a digital producer for American Idol for 24. And again, it was trial by fire.
I was going to say, did you know what you were doing?
No, I mean, no. I would love to say yes, but the answer is no. And it was an incredible thing because I was surrounded by also professionals who knew what they were doing in that extreme. Mm-hmm. And my job was really to build the infrastructure and all of the internal programming for American Idol and 24 and So You Think You Can Dance and anything Fox related.
Wow. So what were the skills that you were learning while doing that you still use today?
I mean, I use so many of those skills because I think what I learned with cooking is, you know, you have your list, you check it off. You're an important part of the team, but you're one part of the team. And when you're a producer, you are also one part of the team, but you're seeing from a bird's eye all of the hands that make the work possible. And you're able to direct it in a sense and keep your timing and keep everyone moving together, hopefully, to make the thing work. Mm-hmm. I hadn't really understood operations until then, you know. But to realize that, for example, with a restaurant, it's not just about the kitchen. And I always believe that. Even though I'm heavily culinary, I believe that the service component is huge. Every part of, like, what makes a restaurant, in my opinion, you have to build a heartbeat there. And so being a producer allowed me to see bigger. It allowed me to see if I wanted to do something in culinary, which I knew I did, mm-hmm. I had to be able to see it from stepping back. Yeah.
So how long did you work for Fox? And what were sort of the best things about it? And what did you not like?
I was there for 3 years. And during that time, again, I really started to be able to get a sense of, like, how I could see bigger. And then I just knew it wasn't for me. I knew that as someone who's so used to working with my feet and being on my feet and also working with my hands, I missed that part of my life and my job.
The physicality mm-hmm. of it.
Yeah. And the artistry, for sure. The creativity, the mindset, the development of some sort of art and craft, I realized I really missed. Being a part of a kitchen culture is like no other culture because you have every single type of person working together for a common goal. You have your HR folks and your artists that are developing your plates, to your general manager, to your dishwasher, to everyone in between. And it is just, it's like a harmonious, strange band, like a ragtag crew that you're a part of. So that kind of experience, I mean, it's that. And then the adrenaline of service.
Right.
That adrenaline of service does come from, like, when 24 is on.
Deadlines.
Or American Idol is on. There are deadlines. And that is like a rush, mm-hmm. right? But there is like a day after day rush of Groundhog Day. You just don't know what to expect. And you're there again, ready for the next day, ready to make mistakes, ready to be your best self. Who knows what's going to happen? And it's exhilarating in the way that competing in figure skating was exhilarating. And you're on that ice and you're just like ready to go and you don't know. You know you've trained and you've done clean programs, but how are you going to do in front of all these people? And what's the pressure like?
Well, there's a performative aspect,
yeah.
I would imagine.
And so it was all of these things you don't even know about yourself just come full circle.
At what point did you decide, okay, I need to get back to the culinary world? And how did you make that transition?
My job got moved out here, and I knew that I was just not the version of myself that I wanted to be. And I was struggling with how to move on because I was doing well. I was making a great living, benefits, healthcare.
Mom was proud.
Mom's proud. You know, she's going to her friends. She's a producer. And I just knew, I was like, I'd saved up enough money. The financial crisis was really strong and imminent. And I had this feeling that, like, I just wasn't me. I was not the best version of me. So I started baking. I ended up, like, reaching out to a bakery here in Los Angeles called the Village Bakery, which is still around. And they had a huge, at the time, bread arm of their bakery. And I hadn't done bread. Mm. And I don't know, I was the right person at the right time. They also needed someone to do, like, the midnight to 8 a.m. shift. And so I learned how to be a bread baker. So
wait, while you were still working as a producer?
Yes. So I would work from 12 a.m. to about 8 a.m. and then I would go home and I would sleep for like 3 hours. And then I would go to the office and I basically like pass out in my office.
That's insane.
It was insane. It was like a life that I could not keep up. At the time, it was IGN. So I'd moved from Fox to IGN, but it was in the same parent company. Mm-hmm. And IGN went through its fourth round of layoffs, and the LA office basically dissolved. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I think some people have this, they leap, and I needed to be like kicked out, you know? And at that point, it was like, all right, it's all or nothing, you know? It's all or nothing. And that was when, I think that was when I could be the best version of myself, when I was like, it's all, you know?
So that job goes away. Mm-hmm. Now you can just focus on the culinary piece. You're making bread. You're honing that skill. Mm-hmm. What did you do next?
I had reached out to Annie, and Annie was, she had just opened a place called Abattoir in Atlanta, and she knew that I was going to be crazy over the holidays. And I said, look, I'm happy to come help. I would love to. I know that I want to open something in the food space.
So you already knew that?
Yeah, I knew that. And at the time, too, because I was doing bread, I was also, like, testing out jams at home. Now, the thing is that I was doing a lot of preserving, even in Atlanta. So it was just like a part of the mindset. And the thing as an Angeleno that I didn't recognize was how incredible the market was. I think when the sun's always shining in LA, you just think it's always going to shine. You know, you don't think about the winter. But when you go and you live in Boston and D.C. and New York, but also you work in a restaurant that's just considers the product and all aspects of how to work with it. Mm-hmm. I took that knowledge back home, and it was another one of those moments of like, okay, why is no one doing this here in LA? We have this incredible product. We think it's around all year long, but it's actually not in its finest form.
Right.
So why don't I preserve it in its finest form?
So you started experimenting.
Yeah, I was experimenting at home. I also, at the time, I had started to date someone who then became like my creative life partner. And his name is Scott Barry, and he was at CalArts at the time. And I was like, I want to create a jam line called Squirrel.
Where did the name come from?
Girl Who Squirrels. A girl who squirrels away. Which, all like, when you see how it's spelled, automatically any writer or person, even myself, is like, oh, S-Q-I-R-L, come on. You know, like, I had a hard ladder to climb once I spelled it that way. Uh-huh. But at first, I was going to spell it the way an animal is spelled. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you can't do that. This is how you have to do it, because it's, design-wise, it looks great on a jar. And so he designed the jar in the first iterations in 2010. Mm-hmm. And then I went off to Atlanta to help Annie
right.
with the restaurant. And it was great because she knew I wanted to start something, and she let me work all aspects of the restaurant, front of house, back of house, which I had been working in. But I hadn't really experienced service side, like what it meant to be on the floor dealing with diners. And so, again, the producer mindset of seeing how the holistic restaurant needs to operate was very helpful. At the time, I didn't know it because I came back thinking I was just going to do a jam company, mm-hmm. Which I did. I came back and I started helping at the Hollywood Farmers Market preserve all the product that had been given to them after the markets were closed. So they had all this excess produce and it needed to be preserved. And at the same time, I was working on Squirrel. So I had basically taken all of my savings from IGN and Fox, and I turned it into what Squirrel is. I've not still taken any investment for Squirrel.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And smart.
And scary, you know?
And scary.
That's why Squirrel is expanding right now in 2019 and not in 2013. When I tried to get a loan to expand Squirrel, no bank would give me a loan. And so I've just saved up the money over time, and now it's
It's not the fast way, but it's a very sustainable way.
I hope so. And I think doing the Jam Company was also very smart at first because it allowed Squirrel to start with a focus and be really like specific about who we were and why we were doing what we were doing.
So when you just started the Jam Company, mm-hmm. how many different varieties did you have? Where were you selling? And how did you know how to price things?
So I came back
from Atlanta.
I started Squirrel as a Jam Company in March of 2011. And because it's so seasonally based and relationship based, not only seasonally based, but really about my relationship with the farmers.
Which you didn't know any of them, I'm assuming, when you started.
Yeah, I mean, not when I started. I knew, like, I'm a relationship person. And I think that's the thing about, again, about a restaurant. It's about how do you have relationships with your diners? How do you have a relationship with your staff? How do you have a relationship with your farmers? How is that all connected? Mm-hmm. Why do you want to eat at Squirrel or at, hopefully, at Onda? It is because we take all those relationships very seriously, you know, mm-hmm. and we care about them. And so it just started specifically with the Jam. And because it was March, it was quote unquote winter in LA, which means citrus, mm-hmm. which is the hardest jam to make. It's all marmalades. It's all 3-day process. Mm-hmm. It's all time consuming. And it's also something that 10% of the American population eats, you know? Like, we are a jam country. We're not a marmalade country. This right. is not the UK. And so I had, a hard ladder to climb. I was like, okay, well, I'm going to start with the toughest things to make and make them the best of my abilities. I saw what I would say competitors are like, what Blue Chair, Rachel Sanders, who's an incredible jam maker and no longer doing jam, mm-hmm. what she was pricing her jars at. And I was like, okay, well, there's the
research.
And like, that's exactly where I should price my things at. And so when I started, it was just a friend of mine wrote for Daily Candy and she posted the first article about Squirrel and I automatically had orders. And I was like, oh my God.
I can't tell you the number of women who have sat in that chair and told me that Daily Candy was the first
thing.
Same for us. I mean,
when
Crystal wrote about us for Daily Candy.
Was it Crystal Mears?
Yeah. Of course. It's always Crystal. And it changed everything and really had that power.
It did.
So were you selling it on a website then at that point?
Yeah.
Or did it just mean that more people came to the farmer's market?
I had no farmer's market at the time. It was all online. And then Nancy Silverton found out about me and started using the jam in bulk for a restaurant of hers that no longer exists, but it was called Short Order at the time. And then the jars were at Short Order. And so it was just a very quiet and
But like for Nancy
natural,
to find you, that's a
totally.
Big deal.
I know. She's so special.
Very.
So.
But that had to be an early indication that you were on the right path.
Exactly. Yeah. It was like, okay, I'm in the culinary space in this way. We started doing a farmer's market in Altadena.
Were you doing this from home or did you have your space yet?
I ended up getting that space on Virgil Marathon in like fall of 2011. So between March and fall, mm-hmm. we were actually working out of Heirloom LA, which is a catering company here in Los Angeles. They had allowed us to use their kitchen at night. So we would be like exactly like bread bakers, but now we're night jam makers. And I had one employee named Ty Swanger who was with me until the cafe opened, basically. And it was just like he and I making jam.
So at what point did you decide to take Squirrel to the next level and mm-hmm. go beyond jam and open the cafe?
Yeah, we opened the cafe 7 years ago on October 4th. So we just had our 7-year anniversary. And it was about, I would say, summer of 2012. I knew that it was going to be hard for me to continue just making jam.
It had been a year and a half, basically.
Yeah, it had been a year and change, and mm-hmm. It was not going to work out. My accountant came in and said, you're doing this beautiful passion project, and it's very hard for me to see how you're going to be able to make this work.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't,
From the point of scale?
Well, the problem is, even now, I can't scale. I can't scale Squirrel. Squirrel will always be this place on Virgil and Marathon that has a magic. We make jam. We now make 35,000 jars of jam a year.
Wow.
But in that space. And that's it. That's part of our process. And it is expensive, but it's not the thing that will provide for us.
Right.
The perspective is the thing that will provide for us. And so what I've realized is that there are these things that you focus on and you should be proud of and support, because they're the school figures. They're mm-hmm. the figures of what you do. They're like the heartbeat of what you do. And you have to do it because it's what keeps everything else, you know. And so economically, it was hard for me to look at those numbers. And I knew that I needed to evolve. And at the same time, Charles and Kyle, who own Go Get 'Em Tiger, which is a coffee shop here in Los Angeles, or coffee company now, they were leaving Intelligentsia. They were both like world champion baristas. And they were like, look, what if we do coffee bar and you do food? And I was like, that's an incredible idea, because I've always been, I think having the jam was wonderful because it was focused, but it also was a way for me to hide. It was a way for me to not put myself out there, open the doors. This was now when Yelp was a thing, you know. Instagram was just getting there, but to put yourself out there and to be judged, whether positive or negative, you have to wade through the fear
mm-hmm.
and be willing to go for it, you know?
That's the amazing part about starting something in those beginning days, is that you still can experiment
mm-hmm.
and try things and fail without the scrutiny that I'm sure you're going through or feeling right now.
Absolutely. If I could get that back, I would love it. The idea—
It's a great freedom.
That freedom to just to try something and to fail and to be able to try something else to see if that works, that and time, just like the magic of time, mm-hmm. you know. No one knew who I was. I didn't even know who I was, you know. When it opened, there was no buzz or Eater's first look feature. You know? We had crates for chairs. But what was interesting is that because there were some coffee folks, they would come in and then experience this place that was a breakfast and lunch cafe with a Cheers feeling, with food that represented some sort of PM technique.
Mm-hmm.
It started to blow people away. And at the time, it didn't really exist. PM meaning dinner technique in AM food.
Because for people who don't know, Squirrel is open for breakfast and lunch.
Only,
and closes
yeah.
at 4.
Yeah.
And I thought that that truly was one of the interesting propositions about it, is that we're, from the outside, it seemed like you were saying, we're going to take breakfast and lunch just as seriously as most chefs take dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of dinner being the flagship, we're going to do that for, you know, our, I know ricotta toast wasn't on the menu initially, but for our ricotta toast and our crispy rice salads.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the perspective is shifting, because AM dining allows you to have a little bit more of a life. You
mm-hmm.
know, you're home at dinner time. You can be home with your family. But when I started, people would be like, good for you, Jessica. And a lot of chefs still don't want to do AM dining because it's more expediency. There's a lot more modifications, because I think most of diners expect that that food will be modified for mm-hmm. our delights and dislikes during the mm-hmm. day. And, you know, you just can't put that same level of time a lot of times into the dishes, into the complete dish that you could at dinner. And most of the time, there's not a lot of liquor sales, which are what keeps a restaurant afloat.
Right.
And monetizes a chef. So I would have a lot of chefs just saying, I would never do AM service because, the numbers just aren't there. And for me, it was I'd come from a place of preservation of jam. And if I had done a dinner place in that cafe, it would have seemed so inauthentic.
Right.
And even though I come from a background of fine dining and dinner, I could use those techniques in AM dining.
Got it.
Yeah.
So how did you build Squirrel? Because it is a phenomenon.
It's a phenomenon. Yeah, for sure. It is a phenomenon. And I think sometimes you don't know the answer, you know? And the only thing you can do is just keep being real with yourself.
Do you feel like people got it right away?
Yes and no. Some people, I think still today, are like, oh, that's just a toast place.
No.
A lot of people. Now you get the backlash of being too popular, which is hard. And they're like, oh, I don't get it. I don't even get it. Which, you know, like, I get we're not for everyone.
But that's what happens when you have a point of view.
Yeah. And a lot of people do understand. Look, the thing about squirrel that is very unique, especially in the culinary world, is that there are very few places that shop at the market and care about ingredient and also care about defining dishes that are different and unique from your everyday. How can we make an AM experience so vibrant and so different than what you're getting everywhere else? Mm-hmm. If I'm on the corner of Virgil and Marathon and I'm providing a meal to you, I'm going to make sure that it is something that you're not going to be able to get on La Brea, that you're going to walk away and be like, I crave that and I can only get it there. That is the point. And that's a hard perspective to take because I could be doing a great burger.
Yeah.
You know.
So how do you know when you've created something that is right to go on the menu? And how do you know when it's time to take something off?
It's so funny because sometimes you know you want to take it off, but then that one person
won't let you.
No, or just like always gets it. You know, there's like one regular who without fail just gets the polenta every time. And you're like, Jeff. But finally, you just have to be like, Jeff, I'm taking off this polenta. There's so many other things. And then Jeff goes, it's fine. We'll try that. And you're like, oh, God, I've been keeping this on for you all these years. I think there are examples of dishes that I've taken off that have been total hits, but they are too big. Like when Squirrel started, we had 800 square feet, so we could only do so much. And as we evolved and gained more space in the building, we've been able to increase our level of technique and our level of complexity. And so a basic breakfast sandwich with scrambled eggs, arugula, and prosciutto has come off. But that was so popular. It's called the Famous Damus. It was so popular that I still get texts today being like, come on, man. Can I please get that Famous Damus? And you're like, oh, man. And then there are other examples of dishes that, like, we as chefs are like, okay, that was this polenta dish was a dish that was, like, on the menu since almost the beginning. I know we're better than this now. Let's move on. How can we find the time? And then we finally found the time, you know. For us at Squirrel, I talk about this a lot, which is that hopefully in a restaurant you can create dishes that are like hit songs.
Yeah.
And you just hope that you then get a chance to create a new album. So that's what we're trying to do at Squirrel, is like you just create these new dishes, hopefully that have the same like hit spirit, and you're going to be playing them for the rest of the days of Squirrel. Like sorrel pesto and crispy rice and ricotta toast. Like those are hits. Like those are always 1, 2, 3. We know they're never going to go anyplace. But how can we create like secondary hits, you know?
So what are you working on now?
Casual.
I'm working on a new song that's about to drop.
It's more than a song. It's like a full album that's about to drop.
Yeah, it is. It's a full album for sure. I have a new restaurant opening called Onda. It is in Santa Monica, so it's on the other side of Los Angeles. It is a all-day restaurant, and for first, we're opening at dinner time. It is a collaboration with Gabriela Camara, who is the chef and owner of Contramar, Entremar, and Cala. I think she's most well-known for Contramar in Mexico City.
And that famous fish.
Oh, and that famous fish. Yes, for sure.
The Instagram fish.
And the cool thing is that we're going to have none of those dishes at Onda. So Onda itself is basically a restaurant about friendship. And what I like to say, it's like it's a restaurant that defies borders in a time that we need to be doing just that. It's a conversation between Mexico City and Los Angeles, California. It's fairly seafood focused. All of the seafood's coming from the Pacific Northwest down to Baja. Most of the produce are coming from the farmer's market here in Santa Monica, just four blocks away from the restaurant.
Super local.
Super local, even though the farms themselves are not. And some produce from Hawaii. So we're really focused on, you know, the food and the fish and of the Pacific. And it's a very special menu. And it's hard to use the word fusion because people are going to be like, is it Mexican? And foundationally, it is. But it's also in conversation with the food that I've done so well, which is kind of textural and market-based and fermented. So you're in for a treat.
I'm so excited. So how has this process been, having a partner in collaboration?
I mean, I think it's interesting for both of us because both of us are so used to just having our, you know, our spaces and be a one-track vision. And to come together has really allowed me to see things so much differently in terms of ingredients, in terms of how I build a dish. Like, there are certain ways that she does things that I've never even heard of, and I think vice versa. What she's really good at is making a dish really delicious with simplicity, with kind of like restraint. My dishes are seemingly basic but very complicated. And so it's kind of a meeting of those two things.
There's some interesting tension in that.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
What's a dish that you are really excited about?
Oh, gosh. There's so many dishes that I'm excited about. Let me just tell you a basic one, which is we have corn nuts on the menu, like as a bar snack, okay? So corn nuts are something that we all as Americans grew up with, but as Gabriella did not grow up with eating corn nuts. Even though that style of corn was very prevalent where she is from, it was not something that they grew up eating. So we're getting the corn. We're getting three different varieties of corn, and we're cooking them and turning them into these corn nuts. But the actual flavoring, the salt on top, is sauerkraut that we ferment and lacto-fermented hot sauce that we have at Squirrel that we're making for Onda. We take these two, the jalapeno mash and the sauerkraut, and we dehydrate them and turn that into salt. So that is our salt seasoning for the corn nuts.
That's amazing.
So it's taking something that is on both of us and turning it into a new culinary language.
That is so cool.
Yeah. We do have a trompo, which is, you know, meat that is moving around. And typically it's, you know, pastor. And I'm Jewish, and Israeli trompo is always turkey. So we're taking this pastor, and it's all turkey that's on the trompo. So there's really lovely little things like that where there's kind of like nods to like my heritage, which is Jewish, and then her heritage, which is Italian, for example. She wanted a Frito Misto on the menu. Instead of doing a traditional Frito Misto, we're doing it with kelp from the Pacific. So we are battering kelp and whitefish and fish from the Pacific, but mostly it's basically fish hiding in kelp. And that kelp is being battered in masa instead of like a traditional like Frito Misto batter. It's being battered in the masa that we're making, and they're being fried in that with puffed Meyer lemon. So very California, very Onda, very us. Very different than what you'd be experiencing anywhere else in the world.
Which is important to you.
Yeah.
So what are you most nervous about and what are you most excited about with opening something new and with a partner and on the other side of town?
Yeah, I mean, my life has changed. I'm sure it's like you just had a child and you see how your world changes. And I know today, by the way, is really we're less than 2 weeks away of opening Onda, and I have this great understanding for the life that I'm leaving behind, which is, you know, I've had a breakfast and lunch place for 8 years, and I've not had dinner, and now I'm going into dinner. I've gone from a place where, like, at 4 p.m., I don't have to worry about, like, what could potentially go wrong with service, and now it's 365 days a year. You know, so to embrace that and to take that on is a level of pressure that I haven't had before. I know that I'm mourning this change in my life, and I'm doing it because I believe in myself. I know that I've only done AM dining, and I think that's always been a big question for everyone, including me. It's like, can she do all day? Can she do dinner? Mm-hmm. So here we go.
This is a really exciting time then.
Yeah.
Inflection point.
Yeah.
So one of the things we like to talk about on this podcast is mistakes, because everyone makes them. And in this Instagram filter perfect world, we tend not to talk about them. But I think they're really important because, as people always say, like, you can learn from someone's mistakes. You can't necessarily learn in the same way from someone's success. So can you tell me about a defining mistake, or a small mistake, or any sort of mistake that you've made in your career and what you've learned from it?
Let's talk about hiring.
Because management is a whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So Squirrel, you know, we started out with me, one person. And then now at Squirrel, we're 42. Over at Onda, we'd have 50 people. I think a big mistake that I have made in the past is not trusting myself, not trusting my core values, and to ask myself what the core values are when hiring. Sometimes I think it's really easy to be enamored by someone's skill. And in this industry, we have to hire not only for skill, but for how you work with other people, how you communicate to other people, how you treat other people. I know I've made a mistake in the past where I've hired based on talent and not based on teamwork mm-hmm. and your ability to lead. And I learned so much from that mistake. So the core value in me is just like, how do you create a holistic restaurant where there's like, it leads with kindness and consideration for everyone involved? Because honestly, that's the most important thing. We have to deal with so many things that we're unprepared for every day that the best thing we can do is be good to each other.
I strongly agree with that.
Yeah.
Another thing that we talk about a lot on this podcast is changing lanes, because obviously everyone who comes on this podcast has had some version of that in their lives. What advice would you give someone who has that passion for another industry, or a maybe even the same industry, but a different aspect of it, but hasn't been able to take the leap quite yet?
Try to find some time to do that. I would say 100% do it. And it can be as easy as dedicating 6 hours on Saturday and Sunday to staging at a place. I had a friend who now is the director of ops at Russ and Daughters, and she was not working in that industry, and she ended up asking if she could work at the appetizer store just on the weekends. And she was like the nut person. Like, she would fill like the chocolates and the nuts. And I think that allowed her to see if she was even, she put a little bit of a toe in, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think allowing for that little bit of toe allows you to see if you like are interested in more. But if you are interested in more, you have to be willing to do it 100%.
Speaking of which, so I think that there's a lot of people are hobbyists. Mm-hmm. How do you know when the difference between being a hobbyist and mm-hmm. enjoying it for what it is and making that next step? Like, what was that moment for you where food went from being a hobby, a joy, a pleasure, something that you did on the side, to really hearing that voice that said, no, do this full time?
I think in part it was the culture, you know. Part of it is, you know, the art and the work that you're doing. And then it's also a culture of people around you who are passionate about the same things that you're passionate about. And it makes you realize, like, that those are your people. If you can find that you love what you do, but you're also surrounded by people who are, like, passionate in that same way, I think maybe that's how I knew that it went from being a hobby to being like, oh, this is where I fit in. This is what I need to do in my life.
So my last question is also my favorite question, which is, if you could go back in time and speak with your younger self, what advice would you give her?
Well, I think I spoke about this, but just listen to your core values. It's something that I ask myself all the time now that I think I didn't really ask myself until I started therapy, you know? And once someone asked me, like, what are your core values? You start to realize, like, what is important to you. For me, it is this holistic sense of community. And it's developing a future in food where that value is considered.
I love that.
Yeah.
It's a through line in your career. Okay, so one last thing. You have a cookbook coming out next year.
I do.
When does it come out?
I have a cookbook coming out April 2020.
You have one out already because I own it.
Yeah, it's called Everything I Want to Eat, and that one is our, you know, first iteration of squirrel recipes. Mm-hmm. But the jam book is what's coming out in 2020. It's something I've been working on for 2 years because the seasons keep changing, and so we keep evolving and adding recipes, and it's very single subject, but it's the iconic thing of squirrel, and I'm assuming a lot of breakfast cafes will use it, own it, and start making more jam, which I'm excited to see if that, you know, premonition is true. I also have something called Squirrel Away opening, which is a little bit more of a fast casual restaurant, that cafe that will be not just in LA, but hopefully in other cities. Different menu, different food, but same consideration for product and a little bit more expediency. So I'm excited about that. That's going to open early 2020 in LA. First location is 6 blocks away from Squirrel.
Great. That's my neighborhood.
Yeah, it's your neighborhood. Somebody will see you there too.
That was chef and owner of Squirrel and co-executive chef of Onda, Jessica Coslow. For more inspiring interviews with women like Jessica, head on over to secondlifepod.com, where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to rate and review us. We love seeing you spread the word on social, and now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Instagram and Twitter. I hope you are following us. We always want to know who you'd like to hear from on the show, so send in your requests to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can just DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr. The show is at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.